Hello, everyone. Welcome to Phase 1, a podcast brought to you by Emerging Professionals Committee at IPS, Integrated Project Services, LLC. We're your hosts, Sarah Bilger
and Moazzam Khan.
And we're back with our 8th episode.
Thanks to everyone who has been listening and giving us feedback on our previous episodes. It's been fun to talk with and introduce our listeners to some IPS employees that you might not have otherwise met.
As always, our goal here at Phase 1 is to give you insights into the life science industry, whether it be career advice, current events happening in the industry, or speculating on what the future holds. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to Rochelle Ritz, who's going to share with us her insights into the industry.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm Rochelle.
Perfect. So it's just like Michelle, but with an R.
Correct. I was supposed to be Richard, so that's how we got this weird name.
So what is your job title?
So I am the manager of process engineering for the Midwest region, but just last week it was announced that I will be taking the regional design director role for our Midwest region at IPS.
Can you help explain the difference between those two roles?
So as the manager of process engineering, the process engineering group proper reports to me, and I also kind of have a wing over the automation group and process piping group, and I am responsible for process directly. As a regional design director, I'm not only responsible for process within the office, but all the AMEP disciplines as well. So I will be supporting our regional business unit director with proposals, with staffing, supporting my staff internally, not just the process team. So I essentially go up to the whole entire office I'll be supporting.
Sounds like quite the promotion. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
So where are you located currently?
So our office is in Overland Park, Kansas, and everyone at IPS calls it the Kansas office. I'm hoping to rebrand it as the Kansas City office because we are not in the middle of a cornfield. We are in metropolitan Kansas City, technically. I live on the Missouri side in Lee Summit, Missouri. So often I'm in my office at home in Lee Summit. I'm in the office proper in Overland Park, Kansas, 1 to 2 days a week, depending on the needs there. So that is where I live and work.
What is a crazy but true fact about you?
So my first college major was not engineering. My entire family are engineers for 3 generations, and I was trying to be rebellious. So my first college major was concert violin. And the second semester in, I was taking physics and calculus and things, and my father and my counselor were both wondering what was up with that. So my dad basically told me that I needed to get a real degree so I could get a real job because I couldn't live with him forever.
Do you still play?
I do, and I recently wanted to try out for one of the local symphonies, and I am just so dadgum rusty that I can't do it. I mean, I sound terrible. It would take probably 2 hours of practice every day for 6 months to me to get back to my former glory. Like, just don't have the time. But I like to play. And my son, who's 13, plays. And so I do help him and play with him. And I help the orchestra teacher in the middle school, like, tune everybody's instruments before concerts and things. So it's still there. It's just real rusty.
That's awesome.
So, Rochelle, how did you end up at your current location?
So, I worked for Boehringer Ingelheim for several years. They're up in St. Joseph, and it's the animal health vaccine facility, which had me develop pretty strong roots in the area in the animal health industry. What led me here, though, was in 2008, I worked for Paul Mueller Company during the economic downturn at that time, and there were, like, no RFIs coming in the door there. And I had a baby and a husband who didn't work at the time. And I knew I had to do something. So I had a headhunter call me to go to Boehringer Ingelheim, and I went ahead and went. And now it's segued into doing a lot of work for SIVA and Merck Animal Health and some other things. I'm like their process engineer on call. Sometimes when they have different processes that are unique to animal health that they do and they have issues with, I come on in and help them start things up, get like full vessel sterilizations going that they've had all the maintenance guys can't seem to figure out for 3 or 4 weeks. I step in and help them. So I've got a good footprint in the animal health industry in this animal health corridor in Kansas City.
Okay, that's very cool. Yeah, I think people fail to realize how big of a deal animal health is within the pharmaceutical industry.
Yep, it is. It's a very far-reaching, and we all, you know, have pets, so there's companion animal, but there's also,
livestock.
Livestock and so many aspects of livestock and the additives and different things that go into that market. I don't think people realize the depth of it.
Yeah, that's true. When I was at Patheon/Thermo Fisher in Greenville, there was a small little, within the campus, there was a small building dedicated solely to animal health, which was, I never got to work in that area, but people did say it was nice in the sense that the quality requirements are a little bit lower than for human health. So you have less headaches sometimes, but
it
maybe
just
you
depends.
Have,
if it's, yeah. if it's, just USDA, yes, the quality requirements are moderately less, but if it's EU, then they are no different than an injectable for FDA market or anything.
Okay.
So there's just some minor differences in the regulatory requirements, which is, you know, kind of where I come in on the design side.
What university did you attend?
So when I attended it, it was called the University of Missouri Rolla, which is the name of the town it's in. They've since changed the name to Missouri University of Science and Technology. They've celebrated their 150th year. And it's strange because at IPS, I was the first person hired from the university. And now we have two staff members that report to me that have gone to the chemical engineering program in Rolla, our regional business unit director that's joining us in January to be named. He is from University of Missouri Rolla. So it's a fantastic university. And I'm really proud to kind of represent and actually bring in some of the alumni from the university into the IPS world because we crank out some good engineers.
What did you major in and how did you decide?
So after my first year in concert violin, my dad told me I can't live with him anymore. So I packed up and I went to Rolla and I majored in chemical engineering. But the reason is probably not that I was directly drawn to chemical engineering, but my brother is an aerospace engineer and my sister is a mechanical engineer and they're both 12 to 14 years older than me. And they said that chemical engineering was the hardest one on campus. Since we're pretty competitive, I'm like, well, that's the one I got to do. I'll show you guys. And so I majored in chemical engineering. It's probably not the right reason. The biological sciences degree as well. So I got a dual degree in chemical engineering and biological sciences. And the biological sciences was just because I'm completely fascinated with microbiology and how that affects the human, you know, world with vaccines and antigens and all those things is just completely fascinating to me. So the two of those degrees coupled together have really made my career, was a great start to my career.
It's funny. My dad said the same thing to me. He said it's the hardest. So he said it's the one that you should do. I also agree with you about the biology thing a lot. I took a lot of biology classes, microbio, biochem, things of that nature. And I think that gives you definitely a big edge when you're working, especially on things like cell and gene therapy projects. I think my first one working under Eric Bosenhart was the Novartis cell and gene therapy project. And that was having the biology knowledge in my back pocket was a huge asset.
Yeah, you know what the scientists are talking about. Because, you know, as an engineer, we're taking, you know, bench scale science to production scale is essentially what we're doing. So to be understanding of what they're talking about is a big part of the battle, I think. The ironic thing as well, so I grew up in Springfield, Missouri, which is the stainless steel capital of the world. I say that. There's a lot of companies that have spun off from Paul Mueller Company, where I initially worked out of college, and they make stainless steel process equipment and vessels. So there's several companies. So generally speaking, I'm like, you know, a rock star when I walk into those places because I know like all the welders and grinders I went to high school with, or they're the parent of people I knew or went to high school with or friends
That's
of.
That's very cool.
And or I knew them from working with them at Paul Mueller Company. My sister worked there when I was a kid. So I really literally grew up next to Purseam generators when I was 7 and 8 years old at the test stand while they were testing them over the summers. And then my next door neighbor was a maintenance guy at Highland Dairy And he was fantastic. He would bring like centrifugal pumps and just all kinds of stuff home, like electrical panels. And so on the weekends and evenings, I was over with Mr. Gaddis tearing apart, you know, electrical panels and all kinds of fun stuff. So it really made me kind of a hands-on engineer more than a calculator. Like, you can calculate all you want, but I can usually make it work.
That's really awesome to be exposed to that, though, at such a young age.
Yeah. He didn't care if I was a boy or a girl. He was just going to, we're just going to rip apart some control panels and stuff together. I also gutted fish and stuff with him because he was a fisherman. So, you know, learned a lot of things.
Can you tell us a little bit about the difference between the design versus the client side phases of your career?
So on the client side, when I worked for Big Pharma, I found that to be very straightforward in a way because I had authority. You know, I could sign a user requirement specification and five or six other department heads would just go ahead and sign it because they knew I had reviewed it. So I just had an immense amount of authority. And what I find on the design side is that's gone. You know, the client, it's not that they don't care who you are or what you know, but you don't have any authority with them, but you do have influence. So I find it interesting in the beginning of projects to, you know, as everybody is trying to get to know one another, how do I gain that influence? How do I get them to listen to me? What are their driving factors? And it's usually, you know, scope, schedule, budget, you know, what is it that is going to make these decisions for you and who is going to make the decisions, like the who and the why. And it's kind of a dance because every client's different. Every client has different needs. They're staffed differently. They might be understaffed in engineering and potentially overstaffed in maintenance. I mean, there's just any myriad of how that works. So the first couple weeks of a project takes a lot of kind of posturing to learn what it is that that client needs out of you. And it's a bigger change than I anticipated. When I started at IPS almost 4 years ago, I really thought the transition would be easy. And it took me a solid year to year and a half to honestly get it. It took a while. It was harder than I thought it was going to be.
I definitely hear you on that. But it sounds like you've made that transition well.
Well, you know, I'd like to think that. I think sometimes it'd help if I had a gray hair or two. But it probably doesn't help that I look maybe a full decade younger than I actually am. So I always think that puts me at a minor disadvantage as well. But it you're right. There's a lot to it, and a lot of it is just diplomacy and figuring out what their needs are on a larger scale and kind of picking what hill you want to die on that day. You know, there are certain things that you can do multiple different ways and it's not going to matter, but there's certain things that if you don't do them correctly, you know, you risk a potential 483 from the FDA in the end based on a poor design. And we can't do that. So we do have to be very, very careful and sometimes very diligent, adamant that no, you absolutely cannot do it this way. You have to have an airlock on your media prep room or whatever it is. And you have to cite what guideline or regulatory guideline that is. It can't just be out of your head. You often have to have a basis for that. So you can't just be making things up on the fly. You have to be very grounded in what regulatory requirements that you're dealing with.
So Rochelle, why is what you do so important to you?
Well, it's always been important to me in many ways. I have always tried to explain. So, for example, when I worked for my equipment vendor, we were making bioreactors and clean steam generators and multiple effect WFI stills. And I think to a large degree, the staff that was doing all of the blue collar work, the welding and the grinding, they didn't fully understand, you know, the things that they were making were really critical to creating vaccines and therapies and, you know, cancer therapy, so many very vitally important things to our society. And so I took it upon myself to kind of teach them that, hey, you might just be, you know, smacking your orbital welder on here, but this is important stuff. And this is why it's important, because this affects an actual person that's a daughter or a son, a brother and a sister. But it kind of came full circle to me after I taught a session at the Keck Graduate Institute on bioreactor design. I often use insulin as my baseline on fermentation for those talks. And it was the week after I returned from Keck Graduate Institute in 2019 that my son was displaying all of the symptoms of type 1 diabetes. So he was 4 years old at the time. And thank God, you know, I knew to tie those symptoms together. I mean, it took me 3 or 4 months, but, you know, he had excessive thirst, excessive urination. He started peeing the bed. I'd never had a child do that in my life. And he was very fussy. And I took him to the doctor and I said, you know, I'm pretty sure he has type 1 diabetes. And they thought I'd lost my mind because I guess they just don't have parents that tie these things together. And they wanted to send him home and see how he did. I'm like, no, take his blood sugar right now. Like, just, I know you guys have got a monitor in here somewhere. Just take it. And it was 440. So normal blood sugar should be somewhere between 70 and 150. And his was just off the chart. So that's when we started our journey. And it's been somewhat fascinating because Charlie has an identical twin. So the doctors were so excited that he had an identical twin for comparison that I'm like, how about we focus on Charlie today? Let's get him some insulin and we'll worry about the twin later. But it does turn out that my three younger children all have one of the four antigens on board to be able to develop type 1 diabetes. It just requires a precipitating event like an infection, and it could be something that is like asymptomatic. You wouldn't even know you got an infection. But it can make your immune system freak out, and that antigen would make your immune system freak out enough to start to take your beta cells in your pancreas down. So my child now is the recipient of a lot of the technologies I've worked on throughout my career. And it's been very fascinating because I get to talk with doctors, you know, about the syringe fillers and the different things and how that side works. Cause they honestly, the doctors don't know. They don't realize like why you can't use a syringe to fill his pump and then give him a shot from the same syringe because it could cause cross contamination. They know that it can, but they don't know why. And so I can, you know, help fill some of that in. So oftentimes doctor's appointments for Charlie end up more of a meeting of the minds with me and the doctors. It's been an interesting couple years with his diabetes diagnosis. Cool stuff.
Yeah, it's really, really good to know that so much progress has been made in that front and continues to be made. Hopefully there's a cure with some of these cell and gene therapies, you know, coming out the door in recent years. Hopefully within our lifetime, we'll see a sustainable cure to diabetes as well.
Yep. There's actually some things that we are looking at as far as regeneration of beta cells that they can use some cell and gene therapy for that. And it's nice to know what's happening on the technology side because I feel a lot more comfortable, you know, making a decision for him if we're going to, you know, spring for like $100,000 surgery that could help him be more normal and go like pump free. For example, that I can at least understand it and kind of weed through it. And then, you know, I've got friends in the industry like Sue Behrens, who is the director of the Keck Graduate Institute, she's an IPS alumni. You know, she keeps kind of her tabs on what's going on out there. Rick Braun does as well. He's always sending me research from Boston University, where his son is a student on some of the research and things going on there. So it's really kind of fun because everybody's looking out for my kiddo on this end.
That's great. That's really good.
Do you have a favorite publication?
So I kind of read a little bit of everything. I like to read all of my ISPE baseline guides as they are revised and updated. There was a single-use technology one released within the past couple years. I kind of devoured that. That was super helpful in nailing down some of the things that we had as rules of thumbs. I read a lot of things from the ISPE magazines that they send out. I also was involved in ASME BPE about 15 years ago, and I do try to stay in contact with those guys as they write white papers and things. So I guess it's not exactly a specific publication as much as I chase a few people in the industry and I read what they release. There's also several podcasts out there that I will try to listen to when I get a chance. There's the bio report and science friction and some different ones that I'll listen to when I have the opportunity.
So Rochelle, what is the most important, useful, or memorable piece of career advice you have received?
So I've received a lot of different career advice, but I think the one that really stuck out most is I talk a lot. So I had somebody point out in my first few years of my career, like the acronym WAIT, meaning why am I talking? Because it was very clear to them that I didn't listen. And the people that were talking actually had some very good points that I should listen to. So now I really focus on trying to listen, listening to someone is showing respect to them and for what they have to say. And I try to listen, not to respond, but to understand. And so instead of responding to whatever someone's saying with my own narrative or my own story, I find myself when I listen to understand, I respond with questions and I try to understand what it is that they're saying. And that has really just helped me a lot in my career because, you know, a lot of engineers are probably not well known for being arrogant, or we are well known for being arrogant and kind of know-it-alls. And I think that I've gone through moments, I would say not huge chunks of time, but moments when I have given that persona to people that I work with or administrative staff or someone like that. And I try to always come back to that everybody has something to offer and everybody has knowledge and something to share. And listening is a huge piece of allowing yourself to soak up that knowledge that they have.
Yeah, I think that's so important too, to be able to listen. And like you said, understand versus just like waiting for your turn to talk or something like that. And it really, I guess, helps facilitate the conversation when you're actually paying attention to what that person's saying versus just waiting for your turn to talk.
Yeah, that's very much. That's how I did. I used to just wait for my turn. And then I realized when I was waiting for my turn, I was waiting for the other person to stop talking and I wasn't listening to what they were saying at all. So you got to just change your mindset. You got to be present. It's tough.
I think that's also something that just comes with age and experience. You know, I think the more life you have underneath, you know, your belt, I think you become better at controlling your anxieties and just sitting and listening instead of, you know, jumping in. I think that's actually recent feedback I got on my yearly review, is to sit and listen before jumping in and talking and come to the client with solutions rather than just, you know, word vomiting all over them that I found this new problem, you know? So I think
my staff knows they can't bring me a problem if they don't already have a few solutions in mind on how to fix it. I mean, we're integrated project solutions. I always tell people we're not here to point out problems. What does that do?
It'd be great if we were IPP. Integrated project.
We're not IPP. We're IPS. I know it's main services, but I like to think of it as solutions, integrated project solutions.
Yeah.
And I can't, was it Brian White? One of our fellows pointed that out to me. I think it was Brian White, because he's very big on bringing solutions. And so I also try to focus my project teams like, hey, you know, do you ask a toddler, what do you want to eat, toddler? No, you say, do you want macaroni and cheese or peanut butter jelly? You do the same thing with clients. Do you want ozone or do you want hot sanitization of your WFI loop? You don't say, how do you want to sanitize your WFI loop? So you bring them possible solutions, and that, I find, moves projects forward so much faster.
I think it does, and I think it also inspires confidence from them.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, because you're not just like putting it on them that you don't have a solution.
Yeah. It's good that I'm not the only person who's received that feedback. Sometimes I worry that, you know, it seems like it's a pretty common thing that people need to focus on more and more, especially younger engineers, is really understanding like when to talk and like, you know, and what you're saying and things like that. And I think it's the listening aspect, I think, is the core of it, and really like listening and understanding, you know, what is the client saying? What do they need? That sort of thing. And I think that's a key skill to have. And I think honestly, a lot of people have it. It's just one of those things where it's like, you have to control, I think for me, it's a thing of like, I have to control my anxieties about, you know, work. And I think that the more I can do that, the more calm I can be, the better I am at sitting and listening and understanding and being, I guess, methodical in like solving a problem. But if I like, you know, if I feel like I'm things are everything's falling apart, people are coming at me with 10 different requests in the same day, then like that ability that I have to listen kind of starts to go away, and I start to my brain starts going into like a flight or fight mode. So I think it's kind of about structuring your work in such a way that you can reduce as much as possible those anxieties and distractions, so that you can really focus on one problem at a time, which I'm sure you've gotten very good at now with all the experience, you know.
Well, it's maturity to a large degree, because it was my very first mentor that gave me the weight of the why am I talking. That also he would always have these awkward silences, and I constantly would interrupt the awkward silences and try to talk, and he was just like, wait.
Yeah.
Like, awkward silences are communication. And so oftentimes with clients, I have learned over the years, you just let that silence linger. It means many different things. It can mean that, you know, you've upset them, or that they don't know the answer, or they didn't even know they needed an answer. That little bit of vacuum and allowing that awkward silence to linger is communication. And I do believe so many engineers with less experience tend to want to talk over those awkward silences. And to me, I no longer find them awkward, which is what Brad, my earliest mentor, really taught me. It was a fantastic lesson.
So do you have a favorite or most memorable project that you've been a part of?
So I've been a part of so many projects, but a couple stand out in my mind because of the time and place, kind of, you know, when they occurred in my life. And the expansion that we did at Boehringer Ingelheim and St. Joseph on the animal health facility was really the first time that I was on the client side and I had responsibility, and I was really good at that job. And it was just constant work, and it was so rewarding, and it was so satisfying, because when you help design and bring in, you know, a centrifuge and a bioreactor, and you see everything that you asked for beginning to unfold in real life, and you're talking with welders, and it's a really amazing to see that stuff come together and to like run product yourself on it the first time. That's a fantastic, satisfying feeling. So I think that, you know, 4 years that I spent working on that project was the most challenging and rewarding portion of my career. I do know that I did some work with Mueller on Lonza, their CMO, and we built their 20,000 liter bioreactor systems and the seed bioreactors, as well as like 80,000 liter WFI tanks and some purification buffer prep and media prep suites for them. And so, you know, every little decision, it's amazing. Like just the tread on the stairs, you know, I can't get diamond plate with this specific specification, but I can get this. And, you know, how to handle every little decision that goes into these things. It's amazing. And I think the reason that the Lonza Singapore project was most memorable is I was pregnant with my first son, and I still clearly remember about 3 days before he was born. And of course, I'm wearing a bright red shirt, so I probably look like the Kool-Aid man. But I was climbing all over this bioreactor skid, and I was, you know, helping welders to understand where their tie-ins and interconnects and how their isometrics worked. And just even like up to the nth hour before I had that baby, I was on those skidded systems. And then while I was on maternity leave, since I couldn't go to Singapore to install them, the field crew was calling me with questions when I was sitting holding my new baby. So that was really fun, because I felt like, you know, you can't do everything at once, but you can do everything. And I feel like then I had it, because I was able to direct the field crew, but I was also, you know, baffling people that were in the facility seeing this, you know, gigantically pregnant woman climbing all around on bioreactors. And we even had the governor of Missouri came to give a speech the week that Aiden was born. And he just looked at, because he was talking about diversity in the workplace, and he just kept looking at me like, this has got to be not real. And he walked up to me after his speech, like, are you some, you know, do you work here? I'm like, yeah, I actually do. You know, women even like at 39 weeks pregnant can do this stuff. And it was pretty awesome to just be right up in it up to the nth hour on the manufacturing side of those large skids. So I had a good time.
Yeah, I remember being out on site with my first when she was like almost due and not being able to almost put my safety vest on because it didn't Velcro or zip up all the way because my belly was so big. But I think it's amazing that, like, you know, we're able to still be in those spaces at that time.
Yep. It's pioneering in some ways, but it was fun. The welders, I wrote down like a list of all their crazy quotes that things they said to me. like, did you swallow a watermelon seed? Things like that. That was my favorite.
So Rochelle, what is your most memorable career war story?
Well, I probably have too many to count. So I've been in the industry for almost 20 years now, and I have seen things. I have seen things. So I have seen injuries. So I have a very strong safety culture just in myself, and I try to help others understand that it's so vitally important. You know, I've seen an arc flash in person. I saw a forklift operator blinded in one eye from the arc flash. And I knew as he was trying to drive his forklift down an aisle, and there was a 220 volt, one of those twist plugs in his way, and he went to go unplug it to get it out of his way, and it was a strain for him. And I mean, this was a big bodybuilder guy, and I'm like, oh no, if you have to pull on that really hard, it's gonna arc. And I just remember like running at him like, stop, and it arced, and he ended up blind in one eye and burned. You know, I saw that. I saw well, not in person, and the video of the surveillance video will always have this impression on me. But a facility I worked at here in the Kansas City metro area had a burn incident where an operator was manually changing out a filter basket for a reactor and made just one minor error and was sprayed with 500 degree oil and had to make a decision to run through it to get out of an area of low egress. He ended up dislocating his shoulder as he fell down and tripped, but he survived. But, you know, OSHA was at the facility, and we had quite a bit of fallout from that. And that's really impressed upon me engineering controls for safety, because the people that are using the unsafe things oftentimes don't know that it's unsafe. They don't realize the danger they're in. And it is our responsibility to make sure that they have the training and knowledge, and that the safety factors are built in. You know, you can't PPE your way out of a burn. You know, a apron isn't going to help you with 500 degree oil spraying on you, which is not. So you have to have those engineering controls in place that prevent people from getting hurt. So I, you know, those safety things have always been very important to me. I know that at different facilities, I've had operators like wave me under a loaded crane. Well, I'm not going to walk under a suspended load. I'm just not. Like, I don't care if you wave me and say it's fine. There's still potential energy there, and I ain't walking under 1.5 tons suspended over my head. I'm just not.
This it's hard like a hat- scene in Final Destination.
Yeah, this hard hat's not going to help me. But you know, I've had some of the fun war stories too, where I had a disc stack centrifuge at Beringer Ingelheim, and I could not find the bowl for this stinking disc stack centrifuge. Like, it wasn't on the equipment, and I'm like, why isn't it here? And I was up on the third floor, and I looked and looked and looked all day for the bowl for this disc stack centrifuge, and it's in a just like a, you know, wooden box, maybe no bigger than like a little wine box, like a wooden, it's not very big, but I couldn't find it. And it's heavy as all get out, right? So I finally found it, and it was down by our fillers on the first floor. And one of the construction crew had been using it to sit on to eat lunch. And that's why it never made it up to the third floor, because he was just kicking back and using it as his little chair. He didn't know what was in it. It was just like this nice sturdy box, and he couldn't move it because it was so heavy. So why not just eat lunch on it? And so then I'm like trying to like ascertain whether my elevator is capable of the weight limit and all that. It was crazy. I've also, you know, I've had incidents where I had a microfiltration skid that I did FATs on. I spent like 3 weeks with this microfiltration skid, and I tested everything on it, right? And it was supposed to be forkliftable. did I ever once look under it to check that one minor thing? Is this fork liftable? No, never, never once did I just bend over and look under it, because the piping for the skid actually hung below the frame and you could not forklift it, which was the entire plan to get it in the building. So there I was with the wall taken off the end of our corridor, of a forklift in place to lift it up into the building, and the forklift can't forklift it. And I'm pretty sure my piping contractor, he had to just walk away and take deep breaths because he was ready to strangle me. And thankfully, he's a friend, Greg Johnson, and he was just like, I need a minute. He's like, thinking back, he's like, never once did it occur to you to look underneath it? I'm like, no, it really didn't. So just, you know, things that are going to, you just don't know what's going to bite you in the end of a project. You know, I've had a system integrator that was programming a tank and a portable tank. And it was so funny because he was pushing the portable tank into the suite where it needed to go so he could dock it up and get the OIT to work with it. And it wouldn't fit through the door. And he just left it there and went home. He's like, I can't do this today. You know, so those minor things that you don't even think about, which are constructability, is the door big enough for my tank to go through? Is this actually forkliftable? I mean, that's a user requirement that was like imperative, but we missed it. So it's taught me to really look at those details. They're very important because you can just take a project and just sidetrack it with just the most mundane thing. It's always what you never expect is going to bite you. On the safety side, you know, I've been electrocuted. So I was doing a tank factory acceptance test at a tank vendor that shall remain unnamed because I love them. They're very nice people. But I had it's a black light that you have to look at riboflavin. It essentially glows in the dark or under a black light. And so you spray the interior of the tank with riboflavin and water mixture. And you check to make sure it's soiled with your black light because it all glows under the black light. And then you come back after you rinse it through the spray balls and you check with your black light to see that all the riboflavin is gone. Well, as I reach for the tank head, I'm on an aluminum ladder. Of course, we're spraying water everywhere. So I'm in a big puddle of water and I've got a black light on a big electrical cord. You know, I'm like 22. What do I know? And I reach for the tank head and it just hum, it kept humming. I'm like, hum. And then I realize that the electrical cord for the black light is plugged into an extension cord in the water. And I threw it like as far as I could get it from me. And like thankfully my boots had a big thick rubber sole on them. And I just like went the other way. Had I touched that tank, boy, it could have just got me. So that's a scary thing that I did. I also didn't realize one day I was trying to close a manway, like a 22-inch manway on a tank. And those manways are heavy on stainless steel tanks, folks. And I am strong. I used to bodybuild, but I didn't even think about it. The lift assist was not engaged on that manway. And I had my one arm on the lip of the lid. And I was just testing the manway and I started closing it. And right about here, I realized there is no lift assist and it is just racing down. So I was like holding it, like trying to slow it down best I could while I like yanked my arm. Had that, I would have crushed my arm, man. So just the things that you don't think of safety wise, you need to like stand and think through the tasks that you're getting ready to do. Because oftentimes factory acceptance tests can be just like the Wild West. You don't know what you're going to get yourself into. The other thing that was, I thought this was funny, but I was the only one that thought it was funny. The nurse at Boehringer Ingelheim was ready to have my hide because I would oftentimes be the first person turning on the steam distribution the areas of the facility. And I had burns up my arm from all the steam lines because I would just like reach in and forget that it was a steam line and just constantly singeing. And I still have scars up my arm from these steam lines. And the nurse at Boehringer Ingelheim was like, no more. I don't want to see you in here one more time with a burn. She's like, next time this happens, we are going to have issues. Because, you know, it's not okay, I guess, to get burned, but I was part of construction is just a whole different animal when you're doing it. So you do have to think and be careful.
So who do you enjoy working with the most at IPS?
You know what? I've been so lucky in my career that I have had so many men who have seen whatever it is in me. Maybe it's my work ethic or my self-deprecating sense of humor, whatever it might be. They have just taken me under their wing and they have been fantastic. And I've had that through my whole career, but at IPS, I have a concentration of it like I've never had anywhere else. Just this morning, Brian Egan called me to give me an attagirl and to, you know, talk me through my new role and how that interacts with, the different groups in the company. And, you know, he's there if I need his help. I've had, Rick Braun is always available to take a call or help me with any technical question I ever have. I don't even think he believes me when I've told him that he's taught me so very much. I can't even tell you. Some of the grumpy PMs out of New Jersey that most people run and hide from. I love these guys. I love the New Jersey attitude. It is just point blank. You don't have to guess if they're mad at you. They'll tell you, So Jim Duffy is fantastic, the PM. We can, cuss each other out 1 second about some problem, and the next minute he asks me how my kids are, and I ask him how his wife is, and we're fine. We don't hang on to it. I've just had such a great time with so many people. There's probably 25 people within the network that regularly reach out to me, to see if I need help or anything. Paul Valerio, he's one of them. He's constantly making sure that I'm okay, and that the folks that work for him are supporting my projects. From the global technology side, he's been wonderful. There's just so many folks. I know that Westerman and Rizak on the validation and compliance side, they've helped me in so many different ways. They've made themselves available for questions. But that's the fantastic thing about IPS is everybody is just so welcoming and open to taking questions and to supporting and helping. And, even if it's Jim Duffy's had me on the phone crying because I've sleep deprived because I was up all night for 3 nights in a row with my son or something. And he's just like, honey, go to sleep. Why on earth are you trying to work if you're this miserable, So I've just been so blessed. And I feel like IPS is just the concentration of where in my career at different facilities and places, I've had maybe one or two people that have mentored me. Here I have, an order of magnitude more than that. I've 25, 30 people. And then I, in turn, can mentor my staff. And I don't even just mentor my own staff. There's folks in the North Carolina office I've totally taken under my wing. I feel they teach me and I teach them. So there's so many people, I can't even probably put names on them all, but it's just a wonderful company in that we share and help one another so much. I drank the Kool-Aid.
No, I think I've had a similar experience at IPS, where I've been very fortunate to have a lot of really good mentors here too. And I think everybody is willing to take the time to help out, even if you're not their direct report. They'll give you a lot of really good, sincere and honest feedback. I think their goal is, I think upper management clearly understands that the more work you do developing young engineers, the more it benefits them in the long run, So I think that's why we have such a good culture here. Culture here is because people understand that long-term success requires everybody working together towards the same goal. And that requires a little bit of investment of time and effort, but it pays off exponentially and with interest in the end.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. That's why I throw my new engineers that start, I just throw them in the deep end. Once I figure they're taking on water, I'll start to throw them a life raft. But, you can't learn if you don't do. And I feel like we do a great job of getting people to do things that they never thought possible, just because they have the support to do it.
So, Rochelle, who are the people that stick out that you feel like you've learned the most from at IPS?
I think that luckily probably my direct manager, Kevin Schreier, you know, he's come on board more recently, but I've learned a lot about facility design on the drug substance side from him that I didn't know I didn't know. So he's been fantastic. He kind of opened my eyes to how those facilities can be designed in a different way and to kind of rewrap my brain around things. Sue Behrens, I've learned a lot from. She was my manager prior to Kevin, and she's now at Keck Graduate Institute. I still go teach for her, and we still have a great relationship. But, you know, sometimes if it's like a facility cross-contamination potential issue, Sue is the only one that will do. I suppose Mark Rizak, but I do still lean on her. I've learned so much from her. You know, Mark Rizak is another one. He has taught me to be grounded in the regulatory guidelines for things. And, you know, it's like citing the Bible to some extent. It's like, okay, CFR, whatever it is that we have to say is the reason that we need to do this. He's been very helpful with those things. You know, Brian White is a true water subject matter expert. And I feel like I understand water and clean steam really well, but Brian just is that final nail in the coffin for me. He's always the one that is able to finalize the track I'm on and make sure that I understand all the aspects of what I'm up against. You know, he's fantastic. But, you know, just on some fun stuff, you know, Karen Ketch, heck, she's taught me so much. She's the one, if I'm like a PowerPoint's not working last minute, that she will come and save me. And she doesn't just do it for me though. She kind of teaches me how to fish. And so I've learned so much about just being prepared and not waiting to the nth hour to do things, because she'll save me. But hey, maybe we should try it the day ahead of time and not 5 minutes before a client meeting before we fix things. So, you know, she's been super helpful. Tim Schuster, he has brought a lot of the science to bioreactors and fermentation and downstream processing that I knew on a qualitative level, but he's really brought full circle for me, like the whys on a lot of the processes. You know, Pat Bossio has taught me a whole bunch about electrical classification. I have been able to, you know, help identify safety. We're using solvents in processes more and more now, you know, hey, identifying where we need to be concerned, where we need to electrically classify. And that's, you know, engineering controls for safety. So he's taught me so much there. Alex Cordaro, who works in the North Carolina office, she's taught me so much. She's like so patient and so methodical, and she's a lot less experienced than me, but she seemingly, when I work with her, she makes me want to feel more professional, because I can kind of be slapstick comedy at times. And she is so straight-laced that she really ups my game, I feel, a lot. You know, the guys in my office, Jordan Strecker, he's so laid back. He's one of our process engineering leads. He's unflappable. And, you know, to some extent, I've learned his level of patience. And he works with clients so well. And he's really good at getting everyone in the room listened to. You know, if somebody didn't get heard, he'll put a spotlight on them to listen to what they have to say and contribute. So he's not going to let people get talked over or railroaded. He's very good at moderating those meetings. So I've learned a lot from him. I could go on, man. Kamal in our office, she's a process architect. On the laboratory side, she's just an expert at laying out those spaces. I've learned so much from her about how to retrofit spaces and how to, you know, sound confident, even if you're maybe not at times. She just comes in, you know, ready to go. She is high energy and she knows her stuff. And I've really learned quite a lot just from her demeanor. And she's so supportive and wonderful. I mean, I could talk for out. Like, I like IPS.
So other than all the other individuals that you've mentioned already, do you have a specific mentor that you've had throughout your career?
So my first mentor, who I interviewed with while I was still in college, and he terrified me, I'm probably not the greatest, you know, book engineer. But as he put it, I was a Urenchant engineer. Brad Yunt, and he worked with me at Paul Mueller Company, and he wrote a lot of white papers back in the day on mixing and on bioreactor scale up and things. But what he taught me was, when you have a problem with 100 variables, what are your two or three important things that you need to look at? Because it's not all 100 of them. Many of them have no impact on the problem at hand. And so he taught me to really be methodical and rule out what we can ignore and like focus in on what is important. He was a fantastic teacher. He was an MIT graduate, and he spoke mainly in riddles because I think he was too smart for his own good. So often I was the interpreter for him. We had a client, and I won't name names because he's a friend still. And he was arguing with Brad about the agitation selection for a particular bioreactor, and he cited a white paper during this conversation. And I was kind of the smart guy's interpreter and trying to help interface smart guy to smart guy. And it was hilarious because I don't think the individual on the client side realized that Brad wrote the white paper that he was citing as the new study. And I kind of had to point out kindly to him that he was indeed speaking with the author of the paper. And he may want to, you know, watch himself a little. He was just fantastic to learn from. He taught me how to do, you know, how to write visual basic calculations on Excel. He taught me how to withstand awkward silences and not talk during them. Just let the silence go. Don't talk. Just listen. Wait. He just did so many awesome things. You know, he was like one of my biggest cheerleaders too. So he was able to get me to do things I didn't even know I could do. You know, I needed to test the oxygen transfer rates on some really big bioreactor systems. And I'm like, I have no idea how to do this. He's like, you do too. Let's look at this, you know? And so he asked all those pointed questions that got me to realize, no, I actually do know how to do this. I have the knowledge here. I just wasn't confident enough to say I knew how, and ended up executing it just fine on my own. But just knowing that he was there to support me was, you know, made all the difference. So that's what a mentor is to me, is somebody that, you know, makes you do more than you think you could without them.
So Rochelle, are you working on an exciting project at the moment?
So as you do that, it occurs to me it's a client confidential project. So I actually can't tell you the client name, but I am working on a very huge project at the moment. It will be in New Jersey. It is a drug substance facility and a drug product facility. So from a design standpoint, it's great fun for me because, as I said, I grew up in stainless steel dust. I have media and buffer prep all in stainless steel with transfers and all of that fun, you know, mixed proof valve assemblies and all of that interconnecting everything. So that's fun, and it's a challenge right now. I have a 10-person team on the process side that's working for me on that project. And the client isn't yet fully staffed up because they are, you know, hiring those key positions still. So it is very interesting to be able to help them because I know they're strapped for resources. So yeah, that's the big thing right now. It's a very huge project for the company, and I'm very proud to be leading that up. So,
what are they making?
They make cancer therapies with it's MABs. So it's like biosafety level like one stuff. It's just MABs basically. So it's like 5K and 2K scale MAB batches for cancer therapies. But yeah, it's probably one of the biggest projects we've ever booked engineering wise in the company. So yeah, that's awesome. It's going to be what helps us push us over into the $1 billion range. So
thanks again, Rochelle. It was really interesting to hear you talk about your experience at IPS.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. This was a lot of fun.
And thank you to all of our listeners who stuck around for episode 8.
The Phase 1 podcast team is having a great time making this for you all, and we are super grateful for the positive responses. If you have an idea or suggestion for a future podcast episode, please reach out to us on Nucleus or send us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
Phase 1 is brought to you by the Emerging Professionals Committee at IPS. Thanks again to our podcast production team.
For more information about this episode, please visit the Phase 1 website, www.anchor.fm/phase1. If you'd like to contact the Phase 1 podcast team, please email phase1podcast@ipsdb.com. For more information about IPS, please visit www.ipsdb.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Phase 1 on any of the major podcast hosting platforms. Thank you.